This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to another Joy 94.9 podcast.
And coming up this hour, we'll be speaking mental health very shortly with Associate Professor Anne Mitchell, the Director of Gay and Lesbian Health Victoria, and Anne, of course, is from La Trobe University, and Paul Morgan, who's the Deputy Director of SANE Australia. And you're listening to Saturday Magazine on Joy, and guess what, Nicholas?
What?
Oh, no!
Wait. Indeed, Joy 94.9. Well, Nicholas,
that was caught
Joy 94.9 Saturday Magazine, yeah, 20 minutes
well,
past
that was
11.
High and By by Till West versus Eddie Thonike, if you like, or Thonike, if you want to be something different.
Oh, indeed.
I have no idea.
Absolutely. Our In Focus session this morning is on mental health and emotional well-being, and joining us in the studio is Associate Professor Anne Mitchell, who's the Director of Gay and Lesbian Health Victoria. Anne, good morning to you.
Good morning, everybody. Nice to be here.
And Paul Morgan, who's the Deputy Director of SANE Australia. Paul, good morning. Welcome
Hi,
to
good
Saturday
morning.
Magazine. Mental health. When we're talking about mental health, before we talk about your organisations, what are we talking about? What is mental? What is health? What is mental health when we put the words together? It's a big question.
Well, I guess we take a fairly social view of mental health at Gay and Lesbian Health Victoria, so we're not thinking about absence of mental illness, but a holistic kind of idea of health and well-being and I suppose being free from discrimination and marginalisation, homophobia, particularly apt when we talk about the mental health of our community. Mm. So feeling free to be who you are and what you are without those kind of restrictions.
Yeah, and it's very easy when we're talking about physical health to get stuck in a biomedical model, but even physical health is not just biomedical, but mental health certainly is far broader in its application and understanding, isn't it?
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah. Paul, what would you say? Mental health, what's the essential concern?
Well, as they often say in interviews, that's a very good question because we deal with so much unnecessary confusion about people talking about mental health when they mean mental illness. People get coy about mental illness. They would rather talk about mental health issues or mental health distress or sometimes, which makes them really cringe, mental health illness. I mean, it's no wonder people get confused. And as Anne very rightly says, we all have this thing called broad mental health, which is like being physically healthy, which is a heck of a lot more than absence of disease. And the same is true with mental health. And it's a very broad condition of mental well-being, the same as physical well-being. And obviously part of that spectrum is when people develop certain conditions which are diagnosable and treatable.
Yes. So before we'll explore this issue a little more, but tell us about SANE Australia. What is SANE Australia?
Well, we were started about 20 years ago, back when the word schizophrenia would make people drop their glasses at dinner parties, the same way that cancer did, maybe 10, 20 years before that.
Yeah.
And we were originally founded the Schizophrenia Foundation.
Okay, yeah.
And worked for a number of years under that name. But we always dealt with a broader spectrum of mental illnesses because almost by definition, if you've got schizophrenia, well, it's no surprise you're probably going to have depression as well. And that's not flippant. It can lead to serious depression, having a serious illness like schizophrenia, just as it would with having diabetes or any other chronic condition that really affects your life, and anxiety disorders. There's a lot of crossover and comorbid conditions.
Yes.
And schizophrenia is hard to spell. It's like giving someone a big spiky porcupine or something.
And there's a sense like it's not us, isn't it? Like other people get
that's right.
Other people's family have
it
schizophrenia.
It just asks for a labelling and exclusion.
Yeah. And it's a life sentence for many people and always considered a life sentence for about others.
That's right. And it's just a word. And it's what we often try and say to people is there are diagnoses, there are labels, there are all they are is just words. What you've got is what you know best, which is how you feel and how the symptoms are affecting you and how you can deal with them. So let's talk about that.
So what does SANE Australia do? Is your role education, support, clinical services? Like what kind of
We're very different. I'd say we were unique in, as well as being one of the older mental health organisations that's national, we're not funded by government to provide any services at all.
Right. Mm.
In that sense, we're very different from others. And from way back in the 80s, we've been very largely self-sustaining through fundraising, through getting support from the Australian community, Australian companies, occasionally research grants or whatever. And we're very much about changing how people think about mental illness in particular, how they think about schizophrenia not being a life sentence that you know would make you want to sort of go and jump off a cliff or whatever.
Yeah, so attitude change.
That's right, that these are just things that happen to people and they're very treatable.
Yeah.
And it's just part of life.
And Anne, we've spoken to you many times during a whole range of events and reports and legislation and setting up organisations over the last five or more years. You're currently the Director of Gay and Lesbian Health Victoria and a researcher at La Trobe at the Australian Centre for Sex
Health and Society.
Tell us about your organisations and what roles they play in mental health.
Gay and Lesbian Health Victoria is a government-funded unit, and that makes it sound bigger than it is. It's really only like 2.5 of us inside the Australian Research Centre for Sex, Health and Society. They auspice it. And the role of Gay and Lesbian Health Victoria is to be across all the health issues, I suppose, in the way they affect gay and lesbian people in particular, and to try and work with services, that is through training and resourcing and posters and all those kinds of things, to make them more sensitive and to the needs of gay and lesbian people, and then to be able to advertise that they are and improve the service use of people in our community. But we also run a clearinghouse that has health information on it, and all the time we're developing specific health information for gay and lesbian people.
So can we ask you both, what do you think are the current big issues in mental health? Again, a big question, but and it's a never-ending question and issues that have been around. But like, what are the current areas of concern, current areas of research, current concerns that your organisations have?
Well,
you go first. They both drew breath.
Yeah. Well, us, there are two issues, I think, for Gay and Lesbian Health Victoria, and we've just put in a submission to the government discussion paper about mental health, so we're pretty well versed on these issues. There's plenty of research, really, to show the kinds of issues that are important for our community, so we're not probably pushing the research side of it as much as the practice side of it now. The two big issues, I think, are the kind of depression and anxiety and the general lack of well-being that arises from living in a society that's homophobic. And so everything that goes with that does lead to worse mental health outcomes in terms of depression, anxiety and other kinds of social responses, I suppose, to homophobia. That's one issue. And the other issue is people who have mental illnesses need good services that are able to deal well with gay and lesbian people. And we don't think the mental health sort of acute system is doing that well at the moment. So we want to improve that.
Do you think that homophobia and then growing up gay or lesbian and experiencing a lot of homophobia can cause or lead to depression or anxiety, or do you think it exaggerates it or exacerbates it in some way?
I think it's pretty clear it causes it, because we've got much higher levels of depression and anxiety in same-sex attracted young people than in heterosexual young people or people who think they're not same-sex attracted at that point. And we see higher rates of suicide attempts, higher drug use, which is clearly self-medication rather than, you know, party kind of drug use. So and there's no other explanation. There's nothing intrinsically wrong with same-sex attracted young people. There's no other explanation except trying to manage the degree of homophobia and discrimination.
So what does it do? Like, what impact does homophobia have that leads to these outcomes?
Well, we think that by listening all the time to these negative discourses about who you are, that you become quite alienated from yourself, that, you know, you try and make yourself a different person. You wish you weren't that person. You wish you didn't have to disappoint your parents. You don't want to be thrown out of the church because that's quite scary. So that kind of self-alienation that comes with hearing all these messages and taking them on board and knowing that they're about you and that you are a really bad person, I think leads to that kind of depression. And we do see kids pulling out of it when they start to be able to tell themselves a different story and say, look, God made me this way, so, you know, it must be okay, or plenty of other people are gay and lesbian and that sort of thing. So we know that some of the big impacts of homophobia leading to depression can be turned around by putting in different kinds of messages.
Yes. I think that's one of the key things. It's not only the negative message, it's the lack of inclusion, that when you're, if you identify early in life as same-sex attracted, there's nothing actually that actually tells you how to be a same-sex attracted.
Or know where you can
We're
go
all brought up heterosexual. So there's no sort of no messages, even just life lessons that you can really learn. You make it up, and it seems to me kids are still making it up. I would have thought life had changed in the last 30 years or so, but it seems to me kids are still having to make up the stories that are going to get them through life and things, and that's very hard work.
Yeah, and they're doing it in a really isolated way, not being gay to tell anybody and get that help too.
Well, some of the institutions in society haven't changed a lot. I mean, you gave the example, Anne, of churches. There are still lots of churches that take a very anti-gay and anti-lesbian approach, and that's no different from maybe growing up 50 years ago, is it?
The church has probably moved least. I mean, we've been very happy with the kind of progress we've seen in schools. I'm not saying that schools are great, but they're moving. They're really moving, whereas the church in many ways isn't. Speaking about some churches, not all.
But it just reflects their discomfort with sexuality as a whole.
Yeah, exactly. It just
becomes a homophobia is just an index of a wider discomfort with the fact that we're physical beings. I think this brings up as well some really great research that's been done the last few years that started in New Zealand, particularly out of Dunedin, where they've been looking at long-term genetic research on a cohort from the 60s or 70s, looking at thousands of people. And obviously, as genetic research progressed through the 90s, they've been able to fine-tune it a lot more. And they've been able to match this up with how people change and develop in life and things that happen to them, you know, the ones who become rocket scientists and the ones who become, you know, garbos or whatever. And they've discovered these really complex but very identifiable patterns, genetic patterns that are associated with dispositions to behave in a certain way, such as becoming more anxious or becoming more depressed, which can affect, you know, great swathes of the population, maybe 15-20% or more. Yes. But they're identifiable tranches of the population who are vulnerable to it. And if with a healthy upbringing, with a mentally healthy upbringing, with a tolerant, stable childhood and so forth, it's not going to kick in. But if there are stressors, and that may include feeling excluded because of your sexual preferences, it may be because of being in a one-parent family, it may be because of shit happens.
It does, yeah.
Then that just pushes you just over that line and it tips you into what could be a lifelong condition.
We were speaking in the first hour with Tanya Lewis, who's living with bipolar disorder, and she used to be a police officer, and now there's a she's a trained educator and teaches mental health first aid. But she made the really important point that when we're talking about what is bipolar, for instance, she says it's different for everybody. And I think we need to remember that for the really high prevalence disorders like depression and anxiety, you can say this is what they are, but people experience them differently because they arrive at them differently. And the way that you've been describing, they might have a predisposition for it genetically, but different life stresses are going to affect people differently.
Absolutely.
So it's not the same for everybody. And we can generalize too much about, in fact, what to do. And but the point is that it is treatable. Depression and anxiety can be recognized and treated.
Yeah, and I think even some of the more serious mental illnesses, like the psychotic conditions and so forth, are also experienced quite differently. And Tanya was saying that often, you know, it takes 10 years of living with bipolar disorder before it's diagnosed correctly.
Absolutely.
And you know, the problems with sort of differential diagnosis of some of these conditions makes it very painful for people who are living with those conditions.
One of the positive, and I'd say surprisingly positive, that happened in the dying days of the Howard government was that they brought in the Medicare item for access to psychological treatments, which I think is, you know, that's bloody world-leading, frankly, I think, to have on public... public Medicare-type system, to have access to 12 and possibly more sessions with a psychologist for psychotherapy. I just think that's so encouraging. And, of course, I always feel that we're always being negative. Whatever happens, we all say, well, it's not good enough. There needs to be more. But I think it's really opened the door to the fact that a wider acceptance that psychotherapy is a really very, very effective tool.
I think that's actually a really good point, Paul. And people should know that if you are, you know, not travelling well, you should see your GP, because your GP can refer you to a psychologist or to a social worker OT for group therapy, and Medicare will cover a lot of the cost for up to 6, 12, maybe even 18 sessions, depending. And the thing is that you see a GP, he or she is not automatically going to put you on pills, at least I hope not, that there are effective talking therapies and ways to actually investigate what's happening with you and to treat it. But if you don't do anything about anxiety and depression, they don't go away.
And if your GP does just try and send you out the door with some Prozac or whatever, don't hesitate to see someone else who'll be more sensitive.
Absolutely. You're listening to Joy 94.9 Saturday Magazine. We're talking with Associate Professor Anne Mitchell, who's the Director of Gay and Lesbian Health Victoria, and Paul Morgan, the Deputy Director of SANE Australia on Mental Health and Emotional Wellbeing.
Indeed, talking mental health on Saturday Magazine with Paul Morgan and Anne Mitchell. And what do we know about? I'm actually saying this from Beyond Blue perspective. You've been doing some research for Beyond Blue in terms looking at what do we know about anxiety and depression, I guess, specifically in gay and lesbian populations. What's happening there?
We just sort of pretty much finished a big literature search worldwide, and we found a lot more studies than we thought were out there, and very consistently finding that gay and lesbian populations have higher rates than other populations, and that usually it's the result of experiencing violence as a young person or other kinds of homophobic things that we've been talking about, like rejection from peers and isolation and those kinds of things. So we also find that it improves a hell of a lot with age, that as people get older, they find more ways of reversing the kind of circumstances that have made their lives.
So do you see any interventions that we could make now that we've identified this?
Look, there will be some interventions coming out of that research, but I'm not completely across what they are at the moment. I haven't read that bit of the report. I hear you say someone else has been working on it, but I know we have found some interventions that have been good. But look, there's one big intervention we need, and that's combating homophobia. And it's really hard to get things that work directly on homophobia funded. Government's happy to fund, or Beyond Blue or anything, I suppose, something that's directly to do with an intervention around people that are affected by it. But that sort of stuff that's big picture homophobia elimination is really hard to get a handle on.
So what would your blue sky vision of that be? You know, if there was a blank check to do something about that, what would you say should happen?
Well, I suppose there isn't one thing that's going to fix that. Sure. I mean, it's a matter of social change, and it's big social change. So we would have an interest in a lot of things like, you know, media campaigns and public education and that sort of stuff. But I guess we'd also be looking at trying to train service providers more vigorously so that the kind of heterosexism that exists in right through the service system and the school system isn't so notable and all that kind of thing. But I don't really think there's a check that'll fix it, unfortunately. I think it's a thing that is changing now. It's really exciting to see some of the legislation that we've been so anxious about starting to get through and so on. So, you know, you can't say things are as bad as they were in the past, but we still feel that people live with a lot of uncertainty. Is this going to be all right, it won't be all right, and that kind of thing niggles away at you. So I'd love to do myself out of a job, but I don't think it'll happen in my working life.
Not in the near future.
Paul, from your perspective, because you'd have an understanding of service providers and stuff, are they service providers, doctors, whoever, are they good at dealing with sexuality with gay and lesbian people or transgender people?
I honestly don't know, so I I can't answer that question in all honesty. But what I do know is there's a huge variety in the manner of doctors, and there's a huge variety in the manner of psychiatrists. And when I say manner, I mean how well they empathise with someone, how well they seem to just sort of click that someone here is in very great distress rather than just needing a script.
And even in their understanding of mental health, like some are very biomedical in their approach to it, and others are much more conscious of social factors and kind of developmental factors. I mean, all of them take all of that into account to some extent, but some in the way they want to treat someone, if you like, I'm doing that with inverted commas, are very biological in their approach, aren't they? And it's a very limited way of viewing mental health issues.
I think that the time has really gone to stop for people to stop looking at things either in a biological or purely social way. We're just a complete mishmash of everything that's ever happened to us and our bodies and our genes, and to try and unwrap those is a totally artificial thing. We're just who we are. We're the products of our upbringing and our families and our bodies, and to try and separate things out is just asking for trouble, really. Mm. You just treat the whole person. Mm-hmm. And I just hate that word holistic, but I just have to use it.
It's very hard in a 12-minute consultation to be holistic. This is the problem with general services. Yeah. As
it's a bit of an overused word, but I think it is important in terms of... And seeing holism not just as looking at everything, but looking at the interactions of everything and how, you know, that idea that the whole is greater than the sum of its parts kind of stuff. You're listening to Saturday Magazine on Joy Melbourne.
Gay and lesbian radio for everyone. Joy
Melbourne. Gay and lesbian radio for Melbourne, Australia and the world at joy.org.au.
And you're listening to Saturday Magazine with Jeff and Nick on Joy 94.9. We're talking Mental Health Week stuff today, and we have Anne Mitchell with us and Paul Morgan from SANE. Now, Paul, people kind of want to do something about these high prevalence disorders, as we call them, depression. 1 in 5 people are going to experience it, anxiety. 1 in 4 people are going to experience it. What can they do with SANE if someone calls you or something rings up and says, I want to do something?
Well, SANE Australia is very much an organisation that's driven from the bottom up. It's one that's just run from just ordinary donations that people send us. It's driven very much by what people tell us is important that they want to find out about. So we run, the most important thing people can do if they're at all concerned or if they want to talk to us about anything is to call our 1-800 number. It's a national free call number. That just goes to an answering bureau over the weekend, and we'll call you back during the week. But weekdays we're open, and it's 1-800-18-SANE. People can talk there to mental health professionals. They can get advice. They can get referrals from our database. And they can talk to families as well about the effects on families, because it's like when mental illness symptoms first start developing, it's particularly if they're psychotic symptoms, it's like being in a plane crash or something. You don't know what the hell's happening. It's absolutely traumatic for everybody. So we can help to talk people through that. And we've got a whole range of booklets, DVDs, pamphlets, all sorts of things that can help people.
Would people often contact you before they've had some formal diagnosis?
1/3 of our calls are from people who are just worried about themselves or someone close to them who's never talked to a doctor or health professional. Right. Mm. And sometimes these people are very, very, very ill. So being on that phones is so important, because you've got this golden opportunity of a few minutes maybe changing someone's life.
Yes.
So, I mean, it's how many hundred ways can you say, please see a doctor?
Yeah, because that's the problem, isn't it? If you've got a serious mental health condition and you're not getting appropriate treatment or support, it can really just get worse and worse, can't it?
Yeah, and there are two things that can be disincentives. One is if you have a psychotic condition or even with depression, your perception is so distorted by it that you may think nothing's wrong with you, or if you're profoundly depressed, you may think that nothing's ever going to make a difference to your life. That's just how the world is.
I asked Tanya in the first hour of the program what difference it made to her to actually have a diagnosis, and she said it was a great relief. What do you think, Anne, in terms of mental health issues, about the stigma? Like, there's a lot of stigma attached to being gay for a lot of people, and the homophobia, and the idea of stigma versus the relief of knowing what's going on, having some sort of diagnosis or label. What would you say about those two things? They can be seen as opposites, but they're not really, are they?
They're not really, and I can imagine that a diagnosis, which helps to explain something that's been very frightening and out of control, it would be really good, because even in terms of the stigmatisation that gay and lesbian people feel, having that diagnosis that it's homophobia, not you, is a very helpful one.
Right.
You know, they're a bit different, but stigma is lessened by knowledge to some extent, I think, or what you experience as a result of stigma. But for gay and lesbian people, they have the double stigma of being both gay and lesbian, dealing with that wherever they have to, and being mentally ill. And I suspect the gay community isn't very good at dealing with mental illness, then, same as everybody else.
And then often with an HIV, HIV or AIDS diagnosis on top of that, which again adds to further stigma, because that's a very stigmatised illness in our society, isn't it?
And it certainly
so
is.
So if you've got all three, it's kind of...
And Paul made the point that people with a chronic illness have a much higher susceptibility to at least depression and mental illness, and often will experience a number of chronic illnesses together, the comorbid factor. And the other thing we need to look at for are people who are living with people with mental illness, who are carers. It's a very stressful and very trying time for them as well, and they're also very susceptible in themselves. So if you are living and or working, or someone very close to you is unwell, has a mental illness, and you need to look out for yourself as well.
Yeah, the Carers Association has been a fantastic partner with us in terms of trying to get together support for gay and lesbian people in that situation and in any situation of caring. They have training every year for all their... Well, they've had their whole staff trained, and any new person that comes on has training with GLHV, and they've got information and material. So they're an excellent source of support.
So let's do a roundup. Paul, if a gay or lesbian intersex... transgender, queer person calls SANE and says, I want to do something or I want information, what sort of response they get, and what do you have? You're talking about a website and things you've got going?
Well, we've got fact sheets on there in lots of languages where we've got nearly all of those available as professional podcasts now as well, so people can download those. We've got videos on the website that people can look at and also get the full versions. Most importantly, there are the human beings on the helpline, and there isn't a story that they haven't heard. They they have a lot of experience over the years.
And are they gay friendly?
Very.
Good.
Would I say anything else? In fact, Tanya is one of our speakers. We have a range of speakers who talk in different settings about what it's like living with a mental illness, and Tanya's been a fantastic member of that team for a number of years. And
that's good.
The other thing people can do is sign up for our newsletter. They can get in touch with what we're doing. And also, we've just this week, we're very excited about it, put up a survey, a completely anonymous survey on our website that people can fill out about, if you have a mental illness, what is your intimate life like?
What does that mean?
About your intimacy. Well, a number of years ago, the Commonwealth government brought out a survey on low prevalence disorders about what's it like for people with illnesses like bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, schizoaffective disorders. And to me, there was all sorts of medical data and symptomatic data and indexes of employment and so on. But the piece of information, the piece of data in that just went just straight through my heart was, when I read it, was that something like 65% of them wish they had a friend, wish they had a good friend, that not someone that you know, just met in the corridor or talked to.
Sense of isolation,
that
disconnection.
Awful isolation. Yeah. And what do they do in prisons when they want to punish and torture you? They put you in an isolation room. They put you in solitary confinement. And that's effectively what's happening for lots of the most seriously ill people in our community. And that is just so awful. And as someone with schizophrenia said to me just a few weeks ago, he said, imagine no one ever hugs you or no one ever touches your skin. It's the more you think about it, the more horrible it is. And it's one of the more horrible aspects of having a mental illness.
How do you think it is that that happens? Like, is it to do with societal stigma and avoidance and fear, or is it to do with the capacity of the person concerned to be able to reach out or have the confidence to?
Look, it's all three. I mean, it's easy to it's easy to always blame society, but it's a whole mixture of things that when people are affected by a lot of these conditions, it just makes people less sociable, less easy about handling themselves, less easy about making chit-chat. Making small talk seems such a trivial thing, yet it's probably one of the most important things that we can do to relate to other people.
Yes.
You know, how's the weather or whatever. But with a lot of illnesses that affect the brain, that just gets hit because it's such a subtle, important thing about language and interrelating to other people, reading other people's
signals,
bodily cues
language,
and so on. And so that really suffers when people experience mental illnesses. Plus, if there's any slightly odd behaviour, when someone has an episode of unwellness, then people are going to shun them. People worry about their kids, you know, the usual sort of
safety
stuff.
Are they going to get nuts with the knife?
I won't go there. And, of course, you get the media beating things up as well. So whenever there's a relatively isolated incident, it's beaten up like it happens every other day. So for all these reasons, people with mental illnesses, particularly the serious psychotic conditions, are very largely excluded by society. That there was supposed to be the shutting down of the institutions and bringing people into the community, but they're not in the community.
No.
They're not. They're locked away in their own rooms.
Yeah. So we've only got a couple of minutes left. Can I ask each of you to just kind of sum up and give a sense of, like, what is it that you would most like listeners to know or take away in terms of their understanding of mental health issues? Anne, what would you say?
Well, I suppose if I'm talking to gay and lesbian people out there, particularly young people, I'd like to say that some of the things that are causing you to feel depressed and anxious, looking at that end of the spectrum, are things that are nothing, are mostly things that are not to do with you. And the more you can put all those things onto homophobia as an external force that's having an impact on you instead of something that's intrinsically wrong with you, then the healthier you'll become.
Mm. And it's kind of like once you do that, I guess there's the other side of it is that there's still going to be residual effects of that, isn't there, that you need to deal
with. All your life. Things can crank it up again too. We find people going really well with those kind of perceptions and then they get bashed or have something really horrible happen to them.
Yeah.
Of course they go back. It's like a relapse, I suppose,
And of course, if you've developed a significant mental illness as a result of exposure to homophobia, then you've got that to deal with, which can be stigmatizing in itself.
Mm.
Paul, what would you say? Is there a kind of a summary?
I think for listeners, what I would say to anyone is that particularly with the relatively high prevalent conditions like depression and anxiety disorders, they can go on for years and years and years, and you get used to them and you think that's just how life is.
Mm.
And that's an awful way to spend your life unnecessarily, really. That, you know, many people, perhaps 40% of people with depression, never see a doctor about it and just live with it.
Mm.
And you can almost get used to it and get used to living in a state of constant distress, worrying all the time about things that, you know, really don't warrant it, to feel a lack of pleasure, in fact, feel almost no pleasure in life for some people with depression.
So don't get used to it is what you're saying.
Don't get used to it. Life doesn't have to be like that. Yeah. And I'm not talking about, you know, not being jolly and running around throwing flowers around. I mean, serious, you know, to live for months or even years on end feeling absolutely flat.
This is where it changes your life or it prevents you from actually living life as you want to live it.
Yeah. It stops you from being yourself. Mm. Yeah.
Can I say that Beyond Blue is works to raise awareness about depression, anxiety and related substance use disorders, mostly alcohol abuse and drug abuse there. And if you want further information about these issues from our perspective, you can call 1300 224 636. It's a national line for the cost of a local call. Or you can go to online to beyondblue.org.au, or for the youth program to youthbeyondblue.com.
And also, don't forget that you can see your doctor now, not only for referrals to psychiatrists, but to psychologists, social workers, other people, and get Medicare funding. How can people contact SANE Australia?
It's a very simple web address, www.sane.org. That's SANE.org. And there's just heaps of information there. And on weekdays, people can call our helpline on 1-800-18-SANE. That's 1-800-18-7263.
It's easy to remember. Gay and Lesbian Health Victoria, Anne, what's
well,
the best way to
the best
contact?
Way into us is our clearinghouse, which is www.glhv.org.au. And I think we'll be putting a link to SANE on our website. It sounds like the goods.
Yeah,
so
great.
We have some information there too.
Well, thank you both for joining us on Saturday Magazine. We've been speaking to Paul Morgan, who's the Deputy Director of SANE Australia, and Associate Professor Anne Mitchell, who's the Director of Gay and Lesbian Health Victoria, as part of the Australian Centre for Sex Australian Research Centre for Sex Health and
Archers.
Society.
I can never remember it.
At La Trobe University. You've been listening to Saturday Magazine with Jeff Hood and Nick
Tolhurst. And I shall say goodbye, and thank you very much, Jeff, and thanks, Paul and Anne.
We shall say goodbye indeed. Saturday Magazine shall return 10 o'clock next Saturday morning, coming up after the news detours. Have a great weekend. Enjoy these lovely 26 degrees in Melbourne town.
This has been another Joy 94.9 podcast. Joy 94.9 is a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station committed to providing a voice for the diverse GLBTI communities. You can support our work by becoming a member or making a donation. For details, go to joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.